Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, this is Aaron Weinacht with New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies. And this is a channel on the New Books Network. And I'm here today with Dr. Eva Glishich, author of The Futurist Files, which is subtitled The Avant-Garde Politics and Ideology in Russia from 1905 to 1930. So thank you for being with us today, Eva.
Thank you very much for having me on the program.
Yeah, you bet. So could you start off by telling us a bit about yourself, where you went to school, how you became interested in the subject matter of this particular book, and so on?
Sure. Well, I studied at the University of Belgrade in Serbia. I did my undergraduate studies there, and I trained in art history. So I started, I guess, my career as an art historian. I then did my doctorate at the University of Western Australia through a strange set of circumstances, and I moved from Belgrade to Perth in Western Australia, and I studied with Professor Mark Edele, working on early Soviet cultural politics and policy. When I completed my doctorate there, I spent a little bit of time teaching at the University of Western Australia, before doing my postdoctorate at the University of Tübingen in Germany, near Stuttgart. And I had an absolutely terrific time there working at the Institute for Eastern European Studies. And this is where I actually completed the manuscript for this book. After finishing my position in Tübingen, I came back to Australia, and I'm currently living in Canberra, where I work for the Australian Academy of the Humanities. So I work on a number of research projects there, and I also I'm affiliated with the School of History at the Australian National University. I kind of moved a lot, spent time in Europe, in Australia and the United States as well. I studied for a little while at the University of Vermont, and I'm a big fan of Vermont. As I mentioned, I started first as an art historian. I was very interested in modern art. And I think probably the turning point for me was a period of study in Venice and working at the Peggy Guggenheim collection. And this is really an exquisite collection of modern art. It includes a number of Russian avant-garde art, true masterpieces, but also it contains the Gianni Mattioli collection, which is a famous collection of Italian futurism. That was a first time that I really was exposed to these artworks in a different way, in a very direct way, but also was able to engage in the history of European avant-garde in a far more profound way and surrounded by people who had an extremely deep knowledge of this period and of artistic development that took place over the course of these several decades at the start of 20th century. I should probably also disclose that I grew up in Belgrade during the 1990s, a fairly turbulent period in Yugoslav and then Serbian history.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, exactly. And so I was... 17 or 18 years old when during those big demonstrations and the October Revolution that brought down the regime of Slobodan Milosevic then. And so I had a very direct, I guess, understanding of how art becomes a political agent and how an environment is deeply politicized and what kind of role art can play in that context. And I think this, in a sense, this personal experience of a revolutionary environment, of a highly turbulent political environment, combined with this interest in radical art, was in a way how I came up to this topic. And I think in the acknowledgement section of my book, I credit Belgrade really in many respects in my experience as a student in Belgrade. In many regards, that's what led me to this topic and thinking about how this kind of interaction between radical art and radical politics, but also what it means to see art as a vehicle for changing our reality.
I wonder, it occurred to me when you were talking about that there might be one other useful thing you could talk about for a bit before we get into the meat of the book, mm-hmm. and that is kind of the relationship between history and art history. Mm-hmm. Like, you mentioned kind of, you know, moving disciplines slightly. I mean, where do those things overlap? Where do they differ? Is that something you could talk about for a minute?
Yeah, of course. So as I mentioned, I first trained as an art historian, and I have to explain that the University of Belgrade at that time, that was it was very hard disciplinary boundaries. So if you studied art history, you studied art history. You were an art historian. There were no electives. There were no options really of moving across disciplines. So it was very traditional form of delivery. And so, you know, you start with your ancient Greece and Rome, and then you move up to postmodernism, and that's your training as an art historian. But I had opportunity to sit in a couple of history courses. And I think what really drew me to thinking about this kind of intersection between history and art history was that I was interested in politics, I guess, and the politics of art in all its manifestations. So while I trained as an art historian in my postgraduate studies and with my PhD, I work with a classically trained historian. And so I started to think more deeply, first about archives, which wasn't something that you get through your training as an art historian, at least not in my case. Thinking about, you know, what are actually the sources for historians, but also for art historians in this instance. I started to read more about social history, economic history, more deeply about political history as well. So while studying of art history, you do inevitably come across some of these strains of historical inquiry. They were not as deeply embedded as what I would have liked them to be. So you focus very much on artistic production, the kind of evolution of different media, training, relationship between artists and art market or patronage and so on. But in many regards, what I needed was this kind of deeper involvement with history. And I think sometimes it sounds that they're such kind of close and cognate disciplines, history and art history. But really, the training is quite different. And then thinking about your sources is also very, very different. So I think in this book, I really emphasize the need to connect these two stories, these two disciplines, in a much more systematic way than that's commonly done.
Yeah, that's kind of why I asked, because I had a similar impression when reading your book. So for the uninitiated, I think it might be a good idea if you could talk for a bit just about futurism broadly, both in Italy and then in Russia, since not everyone may be real familiar with that.
Yeah, sure. So futurism is one of the earliest European avant-garde art movements. It emerged in northern Italy, so within this kind of industrial triangle in northern Italy between Milan, Turin, and Genoa. And I often say this is a kind of first fully fledged avant-garde movement. The French might not agree with that. They will insist that Cubism was the first avant-garde movement. But in many ways, Italian Futurism kind of broke away from traditional notions of what constitutes an art object, right? What is the role of artists? What is the relationship between the artist and the audience? Also, where art happens is completely reassessed at this point. So this is kind of the major changes that are introduced by Italian futurism. The movement is led by Filippo Tommaso Marinetti, who trained as a lawyer, but really found himself more of a poet. And so he would pursue this career, and he will serve really as an impresario for the futurist movement. Now, what's interesting about futurism is that it is what we, I guess, call today multidisciplinary nature of it, because it included painters and sculptors, poets, architects, musicians. So it really tried to merge various different artistic practices. Now, we often note 20th of February of 1909 as the birthday of Italian futurism, because this is the point in which Marinetti published the manifesto, the Futurist Manifesto, in the French daily paper Le Figaro. This was kind of a controversial piece, of course. In this manifesto, Marinetti outlines kind of the main tenets of the Futurist movement. And really, with futurism, we see the celebration of technological promise of the 20th century. Futurists are very much enamored with these ideas of speed, dynamism, of cacophony of modern urban life. They celebrate industrial beauty of machines, of automobiles, aeroplanes in particular. And so this movement embraces everything new, but also it provides a sharp critique of everything that's old. And so they call for, you know, library shelves to be set on fire, for canals to be rerouted to flood museums in Venice, for people to pick up axes and destroy Italian venerable cities, and so on. So embrace of modern life, of modern aesthetics on the one hand, and destruction of the old, desire to remove and to create this kind of clean slate that can then serve a basis for development of radically modern art, and then radically modern life. What's interesting about futurism is that this is the movement that leaves the art studio in many regards, and it moves to the streets, and it seeks to engage with public in a very direct, provocative manner. So this is the first time that we have development of a notion of performance, right? So sometimes there are impromptu performances where artists appear on the streets of Italian cities and provoke the public, try to cause a scandal. They will burst into, for example, classrooms of famous professors while they're teaching and heckle them. They will appear in unusual clothing on the streets. They are famous for wearing those asymmetric suits, so suits that kind of were unusual, had these dynamic shapes and kind of strong colors. So that was kind of one way of breaking out of the studios and trying to engage and really place art at the heart of everyday life. So this is kind of their primary concept here. And of course, they reshaped artistic categories as we know it, including painting, sculpture, music. We see kind of a lot of experimental approach to this kind of traditional artistic categories. When it comes to painting, they're trying to capture this sense of speed, they move towards abstraction. In sculpture, they start to use materials that are picked up from everyday life, so scraps of paper, of metal, and they try to introduce movement in sculpture. And you can imagine how revolutionary that was, given that sculpture is, by its nature, a static object. Here we see an attempt to break this medium and completely rebuild it in a new way. So one of the key tenets of the movement at that point was this notion of arte azione, or art as an action, art as an activity, whether that's about redesigning traditional artistic categories, breaking their boundaries, or simply moving out of that world completely, then entering the streets and trying to engage with the public through this kind of provocation. They also use manifesto as a major artistic tool. So this is the first time. And at this point here, we see their this overlap between artistic proclamation and a political proclamation. Manifesto, right, comes from a political discourse, and they use this now as a format through which to communicate their artistic ideas. And of course, Futurism is a movement that we now today was, from its inception, political, and it engaged in political life in a very direct manner. When we talk about these provocations, they are designed in order to shake Italians out of their everyday routine. And the notion behind that is really to force them to kind of confront a different reality, to shake up everyday life, to wake people up and have them embrace modern life. Futurism, or rather their leader, Marinetti, is often referred to as a caffeine of Europe. It's trying to wake people up and get them to embrace this modern life. And for modern life, you have to be awake. So famously, Marinetti introduces a very different diet for the Italians. He argues against pasta because pasta makes you sleepy. So there is this idea, right, that humans need to be, or Italians in particular, need to embrace modern life, need to leave their old ways behind, need to break away from this traditional mentality and really embrace dynamism that modern life offers. And to do that, they need to be shaken out of their stupor, right? Shaken out of their everyday reality. So this is what art does. And this is so revolutionary when we think about futurism, is that idea that art looks now very different. Art is a manifesto. Art is a provocation. Art is a newspaper article against pasta. All of this now becomes artistic production, right? And in that way, we did this is something radically new and modern for us. So this is why futurism is incredibly important in the history of European artistic production. It really does bring something radically different thinking about art.
So what is it then that makes it such an appealing set of ideas to the Russians then, kind of moving from Italy to the East?
Yeah, of course. I mean, and I think that's a very interesting question. Italian futurism was incredibly influential, right? It had impact from Japan to South America. But really, it was in Russia that it made a particularly strong influence. And we know from our documentation that it was only within a matter of weeks after the original manifesto was published in Le Figaro that the Russian audience finds out about futurism. So we have a discussion of futurist manifesto in a St. Petersburg newspaper called Vecher, several weeks after it appears. I think there's a lot of similarities in a sense between Russian and Italian context at this point. And I think Russia is similarly seeking to make the jump towards modernity, right? To break into or to catch up with modernization and with this kind of new life that is appearing at the start of the 20th century. So I think that longing for radical reconstruction of life and embrace of modern life is a big similarity between these two contexts. And I think this is where the appeal of futurist idea really comes from when you talk about Russian context.
What is it that, to your mind, makes the Bolsheviks such an appealing political Bolshevism, I should say? What makes that such an appealing political stance to the futurists, since so much of the book is discussing the kind of synergy in between futurism and Bolshevism?
I think there's a kind of much interest here in this dynamic between futurists and the Bolshevik project, right? And there's a lot of work that's been done in this field that we still kind of grapple with these ideas. Futurists were certainly Russian futurists, were supportive of revolutionary change. In my book, I note, they were all already involved in the revolutionary and the political turmoil following the revolution of 1905. So in this work, I push back this timeline to capture the history of the 1905 revolution, demonstrating that many of participants of Russian futurist movement became engaged actively, right, in a political life social life during this period. And so when Italian futurist ideas came to Russia, I think they came on, there was a fertile soil there, right? There was already this political energy there, political turmoil, conflict between progress and traditional structure of the country. And this is where the story really starts, when these kind of radical artistic ideas come into Russia that's just been through a huge revolutionary upheaval. And so the main kind of actors in the book are already primed for this kind of thinking, I guess, through their activities during the 1905 revolution and in its aftermath. So when we get to 1917, I think I would like to emphasize here that a lot of scholarship on Russian futurism notes that this is the point where the movement becomes politicized, right? When they get involved directly with Bolshevik revolution and side with revolutionary change here. But as I know, this is actually, they're already very closely involved in revolutionary thinking, politics, and have experience coming out of the revolution of 1905 when it comes to these radical ideas and intersection between artistic and political activism. So as I said, they're supportive of Bolshevik change. They firmly believe that art and cultural domain more broadly have a critical role to play in introducing a new mentality among people. And so this is where the Bolshevik and futurist thinking kind of comes together in a sense. And as I noted, the futurists are very much connected to this idea of artazione, right? Of art and action, or art as an agent of social and political change. And so for them, Bolshevik revolution is really the opportunity to build anew, right? That kind of clean slate that Italian futurism dreamed of, destroying Venice, destroying Italian cities, starting anew. Really here, this is an actual real opportunity to use art to actually reimagine a radically modern world. So this is an opportunity for them to intervene into this political project. So at this initial stage in 1917, 1918, they work on major public projects, public manifestations and celebrations. They're involved in a design and of propaganda trains and steamships that traveled across Russia to bring news of the revolution. They're also very much involved in education, so education of future generation of creators. So these are not going to be artists, right, who create paintings or sculptures, but rather artist creators are artist engineers who create useful things for everyday use and are able to design human environment. And there is a core kind of concept here that modern environment, creating new environment, can trigger creating of new habits and therefore new consciousness. Okay, so this is again where we see connection between this desire to create a new world as part of the Bolshevik political agenda and what art can do within framework of that project. But so we think, you know, revolutionary art and revolutionary politics, in a sense, go hand in hand. But of course, the situation is far more messier than that. And we have futurists belong to very different political groups at this period. And we know that once Bolsheviks come to power, they will deal directly with their enemies, and in particular, the anarchist groups. And a number of our futurists here have certain associations with anarchist groups. And so this is kind of a time where political Bolshevik leadership also shows itself to be culturally conservative in a sense. So there isn't necessarily this immediate connection between revolutionary art and revolutionary politics. And the tensions come very quickly become obvious between futurist and the Bolshevik leadership. But they do share a common ground in the sense that they both see art and culture as a major aspect of the revolutionary project and as a major tool for building a new modern Soviet reality.
I found myself wondering, you know, you mentioned the various anarchist groups and so on. Were any of the futurists enamored at all of this, of the socialist revolutionaries, the SRs, or did they see the kind of agrarian focus of those groups as being a kind of backward looking thing rather than you know, a source of progress?
I mean, yes, as I said, they were very diverse in their political orientation. And I have to note, and there's a curious aspect to Russian futurism is that it is not as focused on modern urban life as its Italian counterpart. I mean, you still in Russian futurism, especially in the early parts, see a very strong inspiration with Russian countryside and motifs that come out of that life that are then kind of combined in this modernist, within this modernist aesthetic. Within the birth of modern art, we often see a focus away from Western Europe and those kind of Western European canons, looking towards the exotic, right? We see that in the work of many artists, most notably Gauguin and so on. In Russian case, they don't turn to the exotic necessarily. They turn to Russia's own tradition, Russia's countryside, Russian way of life. So there's actually a lot of traditional elements within original kind of approach of Russian futurists to this kind of concept of building anew. So that's their attack is against tradition, and this early point, it's an attack against the formal tradition, right, that's propagated in Russian art academies, which is often painting that's very much inspired by Western European models. Most of the teachers in the academies are Italians and French and so on. So going back to Russia's own tradition and peasant life and those motifs of everyday Russian life is actually their way of provocation, right? It's their way to bring down the established a hierarchy within art, and that's their form of aesthetic disobedience, in a sense. So, and therefore, politically as well, they were kind of inclined. They really spread across the entire spectrum when we look at this radical political life.
So would it be fair to say then, kind of wrapping up that general thought that The futurists would have been apt to support anybody who looked pretty revolutionary, who managed to gain power?
I think to an extent, as I said, they were spread across this political spectrum on the left or right, left side. What they wanted is a radical change. So in that sense, they would have been supportive of any kind of effort to bring down the established system as it was. Again, I think there is a kind of huge difference within the movement itself of, and also how they were able to negotiate politically their reality is also a big challenge. What we will see in the subsequent period, once just as we kind of move into the years of the Civil War, is that their theory will very much be inspired by Marxist writing. And so here we will see an attempt to, in art theory writing, bring together the ideas of Italian futurism and Marxism. And so in that aspect, they are very close to that political theory.
So I think maybe now might be a good time to address a related question, mm-hmm. which you spent some time on, which is what's wrong with looking at the futurists as utopians? You spent some time kind of criticizing that in the book, and so I was wondering if you could spend a little time talking about that.
Of course. I think the term utopia is something that, as you know, that appears so frequently when we look at the history of communism, history of Soviet Union, and that is also part of history of Russian futurism and generally of Russian avant-garde. Utopianism is here seen as a label describing a kind of a very innovative artistic production, but one that was ultimately naive. It's a beautiful idea that can never be, because ultimately art can't change our reality, and let alone our political reality, right? It always stays in its own world, in a sense. And so that's the label that followed the study of Soviet avant-garde and Russian futurism in particular as a really artistically, creatively innovative project but one that's dissociated from reality. And so the label utopian here is used in a way that it's kind of often used even today in our discourse as a beautiful concept that can never be, right? Something that stands in direct opposition to reality. But we know right from the kind of history of utopian thinking that there's also a different way of thinking about utopia and what it actually means. And so I know in my book that if we look at this tradition that stems from Louis Mumford and Karl Mannheim and Ernst Bloch and so on, that for these thinkers, utopia was not something impossible, but rather utopia is based in reality. And maybe it's a concept that's not realizable in the here and now, but it contains a future possibility. Okay, so utopian thinking for this within this intellectual tradition really is something that maybe cannot be realized today, but it is based in reality and it is a real future potential. And so this is where I want to shift discussion about futurism, because if you look at their work, if you look at their production, but also in particular their theoretical work, we see there is no discrepancy in a sense, but they don't exist outside their sociopolitical reality. In fact, they are very much in tune with that reality, and their work directly responds to that reality. So I argue my really main point in this book is to rethink Russian futurist production as a form of artistic production that comes as a direct reaction to sociopolitical reality, that is very much understanding of it, and that their solutions to key problems of their time were not utopian in the sense that they were impossible, but rather they were very deeply informed by reality and they were future possibilities in that sense.
You phrased that in the book quite often by saying that, yeah, they had what you called a maximum program, but mm-hmm. they also had a minimum program, right? So could you maybe provide some examples of things that you take to be illustrative of how they have kind of an incremental vision as well as an ideal long-term vision?
Yeah, sure. Well, I'd like maybe to talk about two examples here, both extremely well known. The first is the Tatlin Tower. So that's the famous construction designed by Vladimir Tatlin. It was part of an effort that was initiated by Lenin to create all these monuments his plan for monumental propaganda, right? All these kind of major works that will celebrate the Russian Revolution. And so this is like a spiral structure that contains three objects, so a cube, a pyramid, and a cylinder on top. So it was designed as a kind of counterpart to Eiffel Tower, but rather than being static as an Eiffel Tower, it was designed on an angle to show this dynamic movement forward. And these three objects within this double spiral had a particular purpose. So the first one, the cube, was designed so that's the first level, and it was meant to be used for kind of international meeting and conferences. The second level, so the pyramid, was going to serve as an administrative center, and then the top section was going to be the propaganda center, right? This is where you would put together your newspapers, proclamations, your brochures, radio and telegraph. It was a radio and telegraph broadcasting station. It was imagined to have this projector that would show slogans or project slogans on the Moscow sky and so on. And so oftentimes you will see the design for this monument on covers of histories of Russian art or history of Russian Revolution, symbolizing this utopian concept, right? This is incredibly innovative, interesting project, but one that could never be, one that could never be built. It will always be what we call paper architecture, right? And so a lot of futurist production was seen in that way. Ingenious, right? But ultimately impractical. But if you look at the theoretical writing behind it and the thinking behind this Tatlin's project, and in particular the work by art historian Nikolai Punin, who was Tatlin's contemporary, what's important, the way that they write about it is that this is production that moves into a new direction. Right? It doesn't matter whether it's built or not, although they hope that it would be, but it's rather it shifts our thinking away from traditional models. So from traditional, you know, monuments with bearded figures that no one pays attention to, right? This is a radically modern or radically different way of thinking what a monument and utilitarian monument might look like. One that will make people stop and think and that will change their mindset, right? So this is what we, fundamentally what they argue is that these are projects that are about shifting the way we think away from traditional models and towards something that's dramatically different and radically new, something that can actually shape modern consciousness. In a similar way, we see discussion about Alexander Rodchenko's famous Workers' Club. So that's a club that's designed as a space that would exist within factories and institutes where workers could go after a long day of work and rest, right? And it was this beautifully designed modernist space with room for reading, and there were other amenities that would help people or help workers inform themselves, right? Educate themselves, have that kind of balanced life of work and continual self-betterment, right? And this is kind of an ideal model of what this workers' club could look like. But of course, they understood that in many instances, that was simply not possible within Russian conditions, especially we're talking about a period of new economic policy, of great kind of economic stress and difficulties in producing anything at that point. But what they write about is the fact that, okay, maybe we can't build this club today, but this is a pathway for us for the future. And instead of using decoration to hide or to mask our reality, it's better to have this kind of minimum program. What are the steps, small steps that we can do today? So if we can't, we can fix a broken clock and we can set up a new set of chairs and we can design our space, not in an ideal way that Rodchenko proposed, but moving towards that image. So the sense of, and I think this is something that's been missing a lot from discussion of futurism or rather constructivist production at this point, as we often refer to it, is that aspect is missing, the differentiation between the fact that, they had this ideal program maximum, but they also had this minimal program, what you can do now within the context of the here and now, right?
So I thought that maybe now might be a good time for to think about, who are these artists as individuals? We haven't really talked much about specific people or anything like that. Yep. Could you maybe enlighten everyone as to what kinds of people these are, how they get to be the kind of people they are, and so on?
Sure. So I have in this book a collection of people, and as I mentioned in the introduction, the focus really shifts throughout this book. This work is not focused on a particular artist, it's not about even necessarily about their artistic production. It's about futurist idea and the way that it develops. And so, in each chapter, a different set of actors push this idea forward. So, in the first part of the book, I focus primarily on the group that's often referred to as Cubo Futurists. So, this is a group that operated of artists and poets that operated early in the piece, or from 1910s and moving towards the period of revolution. And I introduce here poets including Mayakovsky, Vladimir Mayakovsky, Velimir Khlebnikov, Alexei Krochonich, and painters including David Burlyuk and Vladimir Tatlin, Larionov, Kamensky. So they are quite well-known figures in terms of their artistic production, both painters and artists, painters and poets working together at this point. Many of them, what's interesting here is that many of them get their education in major centers in St. Petersburg and Moscow, but they come from the provinces, and this is, they come from all over the Russian Empire at this point. And this is what's quite interesting, because they don't necessarily come from privileged backgrounds. They're not people from capital cities, and their provocation is also the provocation of their background, right? That they come as intruders in a sense into this kind of high culture of capital cities. So that's the focus in the first chapter. I then move to look at the work of the key theorists behind futurist movement. So I focus on the work of Nikolai Punin, Ossip Brik, and Boris Kushner. So these are writers, art theorists that will be kind of critical for merging ideas of futurism with Marxist ideas. I continue in the subsequent chapter focusing on key theorists, so Sergei Tretyakov, Boris Arvatov, and Nikolai Chuzhak, who are all kind of also were politically active, but engaged in this concept of proletarian culture first and foremost, and then through that start thinking about what futurism, or how futurism can be thought of as proletarian art. And then in the final chapter, I focus on two key political figures when it comes to this field. That's Anatoly Lunacharsky. He's the Commissar of Enlightenment in the Soviet government. And then Leon Trotsky, leader of the opposition and the left opposition, and also someone who wrote extensively about artistic production and the role of art within the context of the Soviet revolutionary project. The book starts and closes with Mayakovsky. It's hard, even if you move away from treatment of futurism through particular artists and poets, it's impossible to avoid Mayakovsky. He opens this book. It's a nice talk about his police file that was opened during late Tsarist period when he was placed under surveillance during his teenage years because of his involvement in some of the revolutionary activities in Moscow. And I close the book with another file, a file that's opened when Mayakovsky committed suicide in 1930. And following his suicide, the Soviet secret police opened a file that investigated the reasons behind his suicide, but also the debates that were raised at this period, whether he ended his life because he was unhappy with the way that Soviet political life was unfolding. And since he was so popular both across the Soviet Union but also internationally, there was kind of a concern how his suicide might be interpreted. So this file, surveillance of these kind of conversations starts following his death. So he, and throughout the book, he appears as a kind of a key figure that ties a lot of things together for us in this story. As a note, a very diverse collection of people across the book, but at each point, the focus is that this is the concentration of people that pushed the development of futurism in Russia to a new level.
What did they conclude about Mayakovsky's suicide?
it's a very interesting file. They collect all kinds of testimonies, and they overhear conversations surveil this conversation among Russian intelligentsia. Look, to this day, I mean, there are books written in Russia about this file. And on the one hand, there is, you know, always that conspiracy theory framework where, of course, it was the state that executed Mayakovsky and then tried to cover up because Mayakovsky was starting to raise too much noise about the way that political life in Soviet Union unfolded. And he was extremely influential. So they were worried how his opinions might influence the public opinion as well. On the other hand, what you can see in that file is really despair to when it comes to loss of you know, a poet that was a household name, and also fear of potential pacts for mass suicide among members of Soviet intelligentsia in revolt against the Soviet government, and as a way to signal to their colleagues or overseas what the real situation in Soviet Union really is. That doesn't, of course, realize or materialize, but these are the kind of conversations that we can see in this file. It's always hard to know why anyone commits suicide, we understand that the note that he leaves right just before he commits suicide is a love note directed at one of his love interests at the time with whom he sort of fell out. So maybe this is just a story about love, really, an unreturned love.
I certainly, though, the notion or like kind of culturally significant suicide has a long history before
exactly.
that. Susan Morrissey wrote a whole book yes. about it, as I recall, which I think you cited in your book.
Yeah. I mean, of course, the immediate reaction there is a comparison to Sergei Yesenin and his suicide, which Mayakovsky himself criticized in a sense. And, you know, we know all that big history about suicide as not a really a revolutionary act, right? You fight to the bitter end rather than giving up. And so it's interesting when this happens with Mayakovsky, the comparison, of course, with previous instances of poets and artists committing suicide, of course.
I wonder, you brought up Trotsky a minute ago, mm-hmm. and I wanted to kind of go back to that. As I was reading your book, one of the points that I found most interesting was the connection you drew in between Trotsky's notion of permanent revolution and mm-hmm. then the futurist notion of a similar kind of permanent revolution. Is that something you could talk about for a minute?
Yeah, of course. I think, yeah, this is an absolutely kind of crucial part of the story in many respects because, you know, Russian futurism and this, so we talk about Russian futurism and these later stages, we often refer to this production as constructivism or production art. But in any event, this is kind of a continuous evolution of a particular artistic idea. And we tend to focus on the production rather than necessarily the evolution of the idea. But when we look at especially this theoretical writing that I use for, in my book, a lot of futurist theorists think about futurism as a method, right? And a method that continually changes depending on the situation. So if in early 1910s, the most effective method was provocation, public disturbance of public order, disruption of lectures of famous speakers and so on, if that was the method at the beginning of 1910s, that's no longer the method that they will use in 1920s, right, when they move into development of propaganda projects or later on when they try to merge artistic production with industry and create objects that are useful in everyday life and design new environments in which people can exist and which will trigger, right, creation of a new modern consciousness. So what they argue here is that art is constant, or futurism as a artistic concept is something that is constantly changing. It's a process. It's a method, and it's a dialectic method, right? It immediately it foresees what will be the conflict that's coming up, and will change to react to this future, right? To find a new method, continually new method as it adapts to new conditions. And so, this is what they argue very openly during this period that whether this is a form of provocation or a propaganda poster or a workers' club, they are all part of the same idea. And so the art constantly changes. And they also see themselves as an art of crisis, art of revolution, because they constantly have to respond to changes within Russian socio-political reality in order to preserve revolutionary momentum and to preserve the gains of revolution, whether that's the civil war context or whether that's the context of the new economic policy, where we see introduction of certain elements of the free market economy and so on. So in that respect, they correspond, or they I guess, align with Trotsky's idea of this permanent revolution, of this constant combat and change of method as you move to adjust, to keep the fight going.
That maybe brings me to another, you know, quite interesting question that you discussed some, which is, you know, you spent a good bit of time talking about how the futurists see Bolshevism as a context in which they can work and so on. Could you talk for a bit about looking at it from the other direction, what the Bolshevik leadership's you know, in some cases, suspicions, in other cases, you know, thinking that they could put the futurists to good use. What does the view look like from the other direction?
Yeah, of course. We have a very good set of documents that can help us work through that. And some of the recent scholarship that look at the concept of, you know, what was cultural politics or cultural politics, policy in early Soviet period. We often think about the futurism ended, or any kind of avant-garde artistic production ended in the early 1930s, where we have, or 1932, when we have introduction of socialist realism as the dominant line in Soviet political, Soviet cultural life. So move towards more traditional formats and traditional ways of aesthetic communication, but now filled with new socialist content. But that's not the full story, right? It never is. And the Soviet cultural front is not necessarily united. There is not one single cultural policy that will then include or exclude futurists. In many regards, I think where they shared common ground with Bolshevik leadership is certainly in understanding that, and even before this becomes articulated in politics, in art, it's already articulated the position that art will and culture will have huge role to play in shaping new Soviet reality, in changing Soviet mind, or designing Soviet mindset. We know that Soviet leadership was quite suspicious of futurist project, that they were worried that they are not understandable to the mass audience, which they wanted to reach. That Lenin was very disparaging of futurist production and thought that should their projects look like scarecrows, and that Mayakovsky's poetry should not really be printed in great numbers, only to satisfy the need of this curious group of people who might be interested in something like that. So it's he wasn't too keen on avant-garde as such, but also he also noted that he ultimately was not expert on these matters, which is the line that then futurists use a lot, saying, oh, yes, Lenin was great, but he himself admitted that he was not a really expert when it comes to artistic production. Anatoly Lunacharsky is here interesting for us. He's the Commissar of Enlightenment, as I mentioned, in the early Bolshevik government, and he's in charge of all these kind of cultural and artistic matters. And they have a very troubled relationship with him. On the one hand, he's quite interested in avant-garde experiments initially, but sees ultimately modernist production as a form of the degenerate art that comes from the West. It's a form of an empty bourgeois self-indulgence that originates in the West, and that ultimately, while interesting, really doesn't have future when it comes to Soviet production. So he's often described in scholarship as someone who had the so-called soft line in cultural policy, or promoted the soft line, which consisted of including experts from the previous period, so pre-revolutionary cultural intelligentsia into production for the Soviet state, so that expertise would be kind of harnessed to now deliver new socialist conduct, which you can imagine futurists were not too keen on. Others within the Bolshevik leadership had a different right take, and this is where we see Trotsky's kind of engagement with futurists, who indeed saw in Futurist Rebellion an important component in bringing down the old ways of thinking and bringing down a certain mindsets and starting something dramatically modern. So I guess when we think about Futurist production and its relationship with the Soviet leadership, it shifts. Soviet leadership does not have a unified front in terms of whether they are against or for avant-garde production. In certain instances, they are very much inclusive of it, they support, for example, avant-garde and Russian futurist publications. Also important is to note here is the fact that Russian avant-garde art and Russian futurist production are extremely well known overseas. They become a face of modern progressive Russia. They have huge support among Western European intelligentsia and art circles, and the Soviet leadership is aware of that. So it does certainly use that as a way of kind of promoting itself itself overseas. So it does understand that the influence that this production and this aesthetic has internationally. In other instances, he will try to sideline futurists generally and modernist artists and writers as it kind of tries to formulate what this socialist realism really should be and what this kind of traditional production that we need to return to in order to make Soviet message understandable for the masses, right? So again, it's a kind of interesting dynamic. There is, it's certainly not what we see commonly in scholarship, that the Soviet leadership was kind of annoyed with futurism overall and tried to sideline it, especially after 1932.
So maybe we have kind of time for one more big question here, and I think this is a nice transition to that, which is you've argued in here then that the transition to official Soviet socialist realism, there's a lot more continuity in that than you would think from the futurist era. So you have some examples of that continuity that you've observed here?
Yeah, of course. I mean, this is a major question, especially in our theory, thinking about this period, what is this relationship between the avant-gardist production, right, Russian futurism, and then what we will see, this socialist realism, which seem so dramatically different, right? Complete opposite, in a sense. With socialist realism, we have returned to traditional formats of production. We see figurative painting. So it seems in first instance that they couldn't be more apart. If Russian futurists talk about provocation, about a poster here or a workers' club, socialist realism will give us those famous paintings, right, of peasants and pioneers and so on. But actually, there's a lot of connection here in the way that these aesthetics develops over this period. And we have some terrific works by Boris Groys, who discusses this in great detail, where he notes that the connection here is really understanding that art is a critical part of in shaping social consciousness. Both projects are optimistic. So futurism is really defined by its optimism, by its embrace of modernity rather than shying away from it. And social realism is similarly infused by that optimistic worldview. As I said, both of these concepts, right, focus on how art can transform everyday life. But my argument is that this is not simply a theoretical continuation, but even practical one and actually real life one, is a lot of these artists will continue working within the Soviet system. They will continue producing various forms of various types of art, whether that's in shape of a photo book or through direct education of future artists. In architecture as well, we see a very clear continuity between constructivist projects and social realist projects. So I emphasize in my book that this is not just a theoretical continuity and relationship between these two aesthetic movements, but that there is a kind of a physical continuity as well, with a lot of these artists participating in projects that will in fact define socialist realism as a Soviet cultural paradigm.
Well, we're kind of starting to run out of time here, and so I was wondering if maybe we could finish up by asking you, now that you've written a good bit of here about this really interesting period in the artistic avant-garde, what are you working on next? Do you have any new projects on the burner you'd like to talk about for a couple minutes?
Yeah, of course. I continue to think about art as its relationship to political struggles. I'm interested in the way that some of these futurist strategies reemerge today, especially within the Russian context, but also in the context of Eastern Europe and particular former Yugoslavia and that space. So the way that the performance is today used as and provocative performances are used today as a way to make a political statement. So in conditions where an ability to speak freely on political matters is severely restricted. So I moved my focus on contemporary period and expanded that to look at comparatively into these post-communist societies, Russia and former Yugoslavia, that don't necessarily often come into view. They're not necessarily two areas that are studied comparatively. So this is what I'm currently working on.
Have a contemporary version of the kind of stuff Padraic Kenny looked at in that Carnival of Revolution book. It sounds like.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and it's kind of interesting. People would have, of course, heard of art collectives like Pussy Riot or Vojna. The artist Pyotr Pavlensky, who's been in the news quite a bit recently, and they very directly draw on this tradition of futurism and of this aesthetic disobedience that was formulated in early 20th century in Russia.
Well, thank you very much for being with us. I very much enjoyed reading the book and hearing you talk about it in more detail. So thank you.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it. And I'm very happy to support this project, which helps us all kind of keep in touch at this time.
Yeah. It's a timely moment to have these kinds of chats. So thanks again.
Exactly. Thank you very much, Aaron.